on this week's program, a conversation with the renowned German pianist Christian Zacharias. David Patrick Stearns profiles Joshua Smith as the principal flute of the Cleveland Orchestra prepares for a Philadelphia recital. And Susan Lewis considers the history and continued vitality of Handel's Messiah. That's all ahead this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
In the past decade or so, Christian Zacharias has gone from being a respected, highly achieving musician to, well, another higher level of artistic and creative maturity. This evolution is evident on his latest recording of Mozart piano concertos, in which he conducts the Lausanne Chamber Orchestra from the keyboard. Now in his early 60s, Zacharias first came to broader public attention in 1969, when at age 19 he won the Geneva International Music Competition. His international career took flight after wins at the Van Cliburn Competition in 1973 and the Ravel Competition in 1975. He made his debut as a conductor in 1992 with the Orchestra de la Suisse Romande, and since then has had a dual career as a pianist and conductor. He's been principal conductor of the Lausanne Chamber Orchestra since 2000, principal guest conductor of the Gothenburg Symphony Orchestra since 2002, and since 2009 an artistic partner of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. Christian Zacharias is also a collector of modern and contemporary art, and much of the mostly paintings he owns come from artists who operate outside the influence of the mainstream. I met with Christian Zacharias backstage at the Kimmel Center earlier this week. He was in town for a Philadelphia Chamber Music Society recital. Listening to this new Mozart disc, there's a real sense that you continue to evolve as an interpreter of his works. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's better than the other way around, I would say.
Many musicians get to a point where they say, I'm good enough.
Yeah. Now, certainly this is the way I always used to go, and I'm happy it works. It still works. And, of course, it's difficult to define what it is. And in short-term relations, it's also often the case when I do a program 3-4 times, then people come after the third time, oh, even better than yesterday. And the fourth time, oh, better than yesterday. And then, of course, I always think, oh, it must have been terrible at the beginning of this week, you know. But it's difficult. Also, for me, it's very difficult to decide because it's your personal opinion. What is good and how did you feel? Sometimes you feel great and the result is poor. Sometimes you feel very depressed and you play it like a god or something like this. Yeah. So your personal...
Great art coming out of great misery.
Yeah.
The sense of elegance surrounding Mozart has been overblown. I would suggest to you that what you're bringing to the table now, and this is not to suggest that you weren't doing it before, is that there's an incredible emotional honesty in your playing, and that seems to be getting more so. Is that conscious, or is that just you getting older?
I mean, if it's honesty can't be conscious. I mean, if there you use a word which is the most difficult to produce on purpose, you know. So I'm very happy. I always wanted to be honest. But maybe when you start, there's something in front of it or you don't get to the bottom of what you really want to express. And I have a feeling, too, that things are more just how they are. I mean, that's it, you know. Take it or leave it, you know. This is maybe this kind of honesty. So I'm not trying to produce, which I actually never did, to try to beautiful or pretty things. Actually, pretty is terrible. This is almost the worst. And if I'm very close to honest, I'm very happy because this is where I always wanted to be. And sometimes you are afraid of it. Maybe you beauty is also something we look for. And of course, if it comes with it, it's a bonus. But just to go for this kind of beauty thing is very dangerous.
And there's nowhere to hide with Mozart, right?
No, and he's like a mirror. I mean, there he's very close to Schubert, too. And if you are dishonest, he shows immediately to the audience, too. Here's the mirror, look at this guy, what he's producing. He's trying to pretend.
He's trying to impress you, worse
again. Yeah, even that.
But are there composers, then, who you can embellish and it makes the music somehow more beautiful, more sophisticated?
Yeah, maybe not more, but it doesn't kill the music. I would always say my attitude is always don't do too much because it's still a little dishonest. But say Chopin, for example, of course, is easier because his music carries that in it, you know, and which is still wouldn't
it,
say...
It almost invites you to embellish.
Yeah, but which wouldn't say that I, even in playing Chopin, I would also try to be very, very down to earth and say what really seems to be said there. And that, of course, brings you to a certain moment that certain pieces are not for you there anymore. You discard certain pieces. Whereas in Mozart's piano concertos, even if there are younger ones or simpler ones, there's still not a single one I would discard because they all carry something very essential. Whereas, say, certain nocturnes or certain... I mean, it's not Kitsch, but Mr. Kitsch is softly knocking on the door, you know.
A lot of musicians really want to have a sense of who the composer was in order to be able to interpret what they wrote. You're not like that.
Now, yeah, of course I study and I'm interested and I read the letters or often by chance discover certain sideways and I'm fascinated. But to know, say, when Mozart and for whom he wrote it and how he felt this morning and what he was eating doesn't help you a bit how to play that piece. I mean, the music is in the end the only guideline and also the only judge at the piece. I firmly believe that a great artist, be it a writer or a composer or a painter, when the piece leaves him, the art piece leads its own life. And that's the judge. And whether he was a weak guy or a strong guy or... I mean, it helps you to get a picture. And of course, you are probably less prone to complete errors because of style and history and all this kind of thing. And for me, that's why the visual arts are also so fascinating. They are even more independent because a great painting can even say, forget this guy who painted it, you know, I'm here and I'm in 400 years here, I'm in 800. I don't even change because the music pieces change because with interpretation. But a great painting does not change. I mean, maybe our look at it changes, but the piece itself is there. And that taught me also a little bit, go to the piece and try to learn from that. And when I do a Mozart piano concerto or a late Beethoven piano sonata, the piece itself has so many challenges and so many thoughts which you can have about it or alter or revise or and so on. Okay, sometimes with a little hint from historic things or a little hint from an instrument Beethoven used or something like this. But in general, please take this as your plan or your itinerary, travel itinerary.
It's all there on the page.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, considering as well that Mozart wrote some of his most astonishing music when history would suggest he was living an astonishingly unhappy or unfulfilling life. He was in terrible physical health. He was constantly grumpy with those around him, yet he was producing amazingly beautiful music.
But he was also, I mean, that doesn't always say that that's a bit the romantic view or the genius suffering and then great. But he also was very successful. I mean, when he started his great piano concertos, those were the most successful years in his career. 1784, about, he started in Vienna, he was the superstar. They wanted him. He had a career. He sold tickets like never again, you know, and he wrote the greatest music. So it can also be like this. And the other thing is, when you know what's another aspect of, is the life or is all this important, he also wrote pretty poor things. I mean, he wrote terrible symphonies. I mean, and then I can know, and everybody tells me he's the greatest genius on earth, but I can give you 20 Mozart symphonies, which are really, I mean, the worst Haydn symphony is still better than any of those about 20.
And he wrote a hell of a lot more of them.
Yeah, yeah. And he was the genius and we all sit like this. So I think, again, the piece tells you what is quality. The piece tells you what it wants from you.
You mentioned earlier on visual arts and I know that you're a big collector of paintings principally. Since some would argue that music is the art that all other art wants to be, why this interest in the visual arts?
Because simply I don't see anything while I make music.
Well, you have an orchestra around, you have an audience.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. Many people say, oh, la mer, and then you have these associations. And
You're not buying it?
No, nothing at all. I mean, I'm really concerned with what I hear. And it happens that I'm just fascinated what people can do for your eyes and what people create, especially in the 20th century, where musical interest gets a bit lost for me. I mean, my musical interest ends a bit with harmony or something like that. But to see what people create in this 20th century, and especially also after the war, like whole worlds of vision and of, sometimes it's more, it's not only painting, it's space, it's relations of sculpture things. And so I can't do it at all. That's maybe also why I'm so fascinated, that they create from nothing, from zero, something to which can touch me also and which can draw me into it. I mean, music still is maybe stronger because it enters your body in a different way, and the emotions it can get out of you or into you are really quite unbelievable. But I often feel when I find the right piece somewhere, be it in an exhibition or in an art fair, it's like rails. I go there, there's something calling me, so to say, you know, and I don't know why. There's something which I try to decipher, or maybe, yeah, like things which I don't understand, like that almost gets religious, like a totem or a sign or something like this. And this is actually also the art that attracts me most, which I wouldn't just call it abstract art or realistic art. It's something where you grasp something which is a sign with a meaning which you don't grasp, and you then afterwards try to understand what is this and why does this want to accompany me, and so on and so on.
But isn't that the same with great music? That a lot of the time you don't need to know anything about it. You just need to experience it, and it'll tell you everything you need to know about, well, sometimes about yourself, but certainly about the piece of work itself.
Yeah. That's why.
Did you know about visual art before you started collecting it, or was it necessary?
No, it was exactly the same. As I said, it's there, and you enter a room and you say, "Why does this touch me?" And of course, then you want to know, who is this guy? What does he do? And why is it only this one? There are 50 hanging here. or in a museum, it's the same. Then later on comes the quality. Then you learn, and then you start judging.
And did you have good taste, just as a matter of interest?
I think it was not bad from the beginning on, and I certainly developed it. And I'm very, very critical, and that's why also these words also came into our music discussion about pretty. Also in art, I hate pretty, you know, because this is the easy way, you know, to sell you something, you know. Also, I have a good eye to tell you this is a bad one and this is a better one. But this also gets more and more firm, you know, and it's just fascinating to follow people, and to also maybe it's something which I need as a counterpoint, you know. I'm doing all this music. There's a lot of time involved, really. I mean, I rehearse 3 hours, another 2 hours. Then I practice 3 hours, maybe even four. And then you want me to go to a concert or something like this? No, thank you very much. And even to reading a book is very hard work. And so a piece of art is there. And you can look at it, you cannot look at it. It leaves you incredible freedom.
Christian Zacharias. His latest CD is his 7th volume of Mozart piano concertos, in which he conducts the Lausanne Chamber Orchestra from the piano.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Where are the star flutists for the 21st century? Jean-Pierre Rampal is long deceased, and James Galway is fast fading from the scene. In fact, Tuesday's Philadelphia Chamber Music Society flute recital, this one by the Cleveland Orchestra's acclaimed principal flutist Joshua Smith, is a somewhat rare occurrence, even in a city that has the distinguished Jeff Kaner in the Philadelphia Orchestra. Both Kaner and his former Curtis Institute student Smith explained to the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns why one of the world's most popular instruments only occasionally steps out from the larger ranks of the orchestra.
The flute is the instrument of legend, mythology, antiquity, and modernity. It shows up in some of the earliest artworks of Western civilization and is limited to no single culture or ethnicity. It's the Zelig of musical instruments, always there but peeking out from behind somebody else's shoulder, from high school marching bands to the kind of high-concept programs of flutist Joshua Smith. But in a strange way, flutists are a bit spoiled by their own symphony orchestras. After making cameo appearances in some of the great masterpieces of Western music, they find all too often that the starring roles available to them are the classical counterparts to B-movies. The Philadelphia Orchestra's principal flute, Jeff Kaner.
The flute repertoire is quite good compared to other winds. To everyone that sits behind us, we have, I think, better repertoire overall. But strings and piano, then, of course, we can't really compare.
And if Joshua Smith's Tuesday program of music by Debussy and Reinecke turns out to have surprising degrees of depth, well, he's surprised too.
I find chamber music work more interesting and more rewarding than doing a full-on, you know, just flute recital. Usually, again, for the rep reason. Although this one that I'm doing in Philly, I really, really like the program. So I think it's good. I'm proud of it. I took probably arguably one of our best pieces of rep, which is the Schubert Variations, and kind of used that as the touchstone for that theme, which is basically unrequited love. And all of the pieces on the program are about love or romance or yearning, and they're actually all also based on poetry.
Time and again, flutists seem to have been chosen by their instrument, not the other way around, and often at an age when they don't quite know what they're getting into. One of Philadelphia's brightest flutists is Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Jennifer Higdon. She grew up in rural Tennessee and found herself playing flute in marching band, which is one reason why the flute has some of the more animated solos in her concerto for orchestra. Flutists also tend to progress very quickly. The Montreal-born Kaner became serious with the flute when a freshman in high school and arrived at New York's Juilliard School of Music at age 17. And Smith, who grew up in Albuquerque playing show tunes on his flute, auditioned for Kaner at the Curtis Institute rather fully formed, Kaner recalls, and went on to the Cleveland Orchestra.
He came for a lesson before coming to school, and he was just this extraordinarily talented young guy who played a Mozart concerto just beautifully, and I encouraged him to audition at Curtis. He got the job in Cleveland before he was actually finished school. The orchestra had had auditions and didn't hire anyone. And so the music director at that time, Christoph von Dohnányi, was open to hearing people who might not ordinarily have been able to audition for a position like that. So he had the good fortune to be at a time when it was possible for him to get that audition.
The problem is that the flute isn't quite a concerto instrument, but isn't the soul of the symphony orchestra either. So to stay fresh and well-rounded, both Kaner and Smith have found themselves doing a bit of everything. Kaner plays recitals and makes recordings. Smith has some stylish publicity pictures taken and has found himself reaching out to less classical audiences in Cleveland clubs.
I've done a good amount of experimenting with playing in local bars, specifically in a great little place called the Happy Dog on the west side. It used to be a polka bar. Now Sean Watterson, who owns it, has basically turned it into a really great music venue, and it's a place where you can go have a hot dog and a beer. So I convinced him to try chamber music, and it went over incredibly well. You know, we had people lining up around the block to get into this place the first time I did it.
Considering the potential implied by such incidents, one wonders why star flutists such as Smith don't give up their day jobs. One case history is that of Emmanuel Pahud, the Berlin Philharmonic's handsome star flutist who left the orchestra, landed a major recording contract with EMI, but after a few years rejoined the orchestra. And Kaner, for one, doesn't question that decision for a minute. There is the thrill of being in a great orchestra, but the artistic reality isn't just that one experience feeds the other. One experience is necessary for the other.
To this day, when I'm sitting in the middle of Brahms' First Symphony, it's difficult for me to keep my composure because it's a very emotional experience. And it's been over 30 years that I've been doing this. So to give that up in order to play, I could mention several composers, but you might not have heard of them. It's just, for me, it's not really an option. Even Mozart, I mean, we have such limited repertoire, Mozart, two Mozart concertos and several quartets. I found that to really understand how to play Mozart, for me it was necessary to be playing the piano concertos, the symphonies, operas, with conductors, pianists, singers who really knew Mozart. I don't think I could ever have really had a comprehension of how Mozart should sound if I only knew him from practicing alone in a room.
One could argue that James Galway, for one, has done rather well on his own for the past several decades. Yet Galway is regarded with some suspicion in flute circles. He's gone in for popular crossover music, which Smith has resisted because he wants to stick with what he does best. Galway plays lots of transcriptions, a practice that most flutists embrace, though perhaps more discriminately. Also, Galway has a habit of cutting out his breath pauses in his recordings, creating an unnatural stream of sound. That might seem like a small matter, but to Smith, breath is about musical identity.
That irritates me so much. I mean, obviously, if the way that our instruments work is because we blow into them, why would we want to mask that?
The breath is also what connects this 21st century instrument to the sounds of millenniums past. Not for nothing did Mozart name his opera the Magic Flute.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns, accompanied by Christina Dahl on piano, Joshua Smith plays a Philadelphia Chamber Music Society recital at the American Philosophical Society at 4th and Chestnut Streets in Philadelphia at 8 o'clock on Tuesday. It's December, and in Philadelphia, several messiahs are coming to town. Handel's Messiah, that is. This 18th century oratorio, originally composed for performance during the springtime Christian observance of Lent, has become a contemporary staple of Christmas celebrations in modern America. Now, WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the magnetism and majesty of Handel's Messiah.
It was 1741, and the noted opera composer, George Friedrich Handel, was facing an uncertain future in his adopted home of England. English musical tastes were changing, and Handel was in debt. Then came an invitation from the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland to stage concerts in Dublin. Thinking of a musical form that could be performed during Lent when theatrical productions were not permitted, Handel turned from opera to another increasingly popular style of musical storytelling.
He really invented what we think of now as the oratorio.
David Hayes is the music director of the Philadelphia Singers, now the resident chorus of the Philadelphia Orchestra, which is performing Handel's Messiah this month. Although there were oratorios written before Handel's time, it was a relatively new form in England, and Handel put his mark on it.
He took older forms, the Roman oratorio, the English Mass, the English church anthem, and he combined elements of all of those things to create a large-scale dramatic work based on biblical texts so nobody could complain during Lent, and a greater role for the chorus than would be in an opera performance. He did these performances and could do them because he wasn't using stage scenery or props or anything.
Opera, which does use scenery and props, had been Handel's first musical love. Born in Germany in 1685, about a month before Johann Sebastian Bach, Handel wrote his first opera before he was 20 years old. Shortly afterwards, he moved to Italy, where he soaked up the Italian way of writing for the voice. In his late 20s, he went to England, first to stage an opera, then to work for the monarchy. Stephen Zohn, professor of music history at Temple University, says after the young composer moved to England permanently, he dominated the musical scene there.
It was sort of the perfect storm for Handel. He could set himself up as an Italian opera composer, which is what he was mostly interested in, but he also had an opportunity to write sacred vocal music, which he had experience with for the monarchy. It was a great publishing scene. He could get his music published. So there were a lot of opportunities for him.
He was quite prolific and could work very quickly.
There was really very little concept of spending as much time as it took because it just had to be as good as possible. Opening night was in 3 weeks, and you had to have it regardless of how good it was. There was no real conception of creating a lasting masterpiece for posterity.
In 1741, at age 56, Handel spent 24 days creating Messiah. Its first performance was during Lent on Fishamble Street in Dublin on April 13th, 1742. Charles Jennens created a libretto that was not a typical sacred text.
Every valley, shall be exalted.
It's from the Old Testament. It's from the New Testament. It's a phrase of one piece in one book that's attached to another phrase in another book, and yet his librettist somehow managed to create the sense that this was the story as it's laid out. It's a brilliant libretto in the sense that you never feel it's a patchwork.
To this text, Handel put notes that often musically describe the words. There is a lot of text painting, says Yale music professor and artistic director of Singing City, Jeffrey Brillhart.
The crooked shall be made straight, so the line is very crooked, if you will. And then when you get to the word straight, the voice just stops and holds the note. It's kind of a funny moment.
The crooked straight, and the rough place is great.
However quickly put together, however unorthodox its narrative form, Handel's Messiah became a much-performed piece, even in Handel's day. David Hayes says each time Handel did it, he changed it a bit.
Handel himself never actually settled on a final version, and he was constantly changing it and adjusting it, particularly in the area of soloists. He would rewrite arias, change keys, shorten them, lengthen them, eliminate them, do all sorts of manipulations according to who he had available for the soloists in any given year or any given run of performances.
During the first London performance at Covent Garden in 1743, King George II reportedly stood during the Hallelujah Chorus. No one knows for sure why, but people have been standing for that movement ever since.
Hallelujah! 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 Hallelujah!
The Hallelujah Chorus is something that you always teach in a chorus, and not because it's so famous. It's sort of a masterpiece of manipulating musical texture. So there's melody and accompaniment, there's very intricate fugal writing, there's everything in between, and all of this happens in the space of just a couple minutes.
So began the evolution of the work that lives on today, an oratorio that tells, without specific characters, the story of the Christ in three parts: the birth, the passion, and the aftermath. It's still performed in different versions, with different instrumentation and different solo parts, although the choral sections remain pretty much the same. The way it's performed depends on conductor, who will be playing what instruments, and who will be singing, on stage and off. Sometime in the last century, the audience got into the act, and each year a number of venues stage sing-along messiahs. Despite its roots in the Bible, Handel's Messiah taps into emotions not limited to one faith, feelings that don't grow stale over time.
There's a universality to the piece that appeals to Christians and to Jews and to atheists even. There's such a spirit of hopefulness about it.
Maybe this is another reason Messiah is performed at Christmas. It's a challenging and familiar, complex and compelling work of art that people can relate to on many levels. A spirit of hopefulness isn't bad at any time, but in the darkness of winter, it's a welcome, shining light.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Tomorrow at 4, the Harrisburg Choral Society will perform a sing-along Messiah at the Market Street Presbyterian Church. Also tomorrow are sing-along Messiahs at Cumberland County College in Vineland, New Jersey, and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Broomall, Pennsylvania. Next Sunday, the Philadelphia Orchestra performs Handel's Messiah with the Philadelphia Singers Chorale at 7:30 at the Kimmel Center. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.